Hi, I'm Amy Siegel-Shorey from GMA Foundations in Boston. We work with a lot of family foundations. And I'm the session designer here, but I'm not the expert. These two are the experts, and you'll hear a lot more from them later. We sometimes think about what's special about family foundations in their communities. They have a lot of connections. Connections with each other, connections with their own philanthropic systems. Their roots are deep, and their networks are broad. They're in touch with community needs as they know them and as they feel them. And it's often both of those things. They sometimes build from their own family experiences. They can afford to take risks, and sometimes do. They may have a lot of connections with other donors. And so in the systems view that we're thinking about, they're parts of a lot of different systems in their own communities. So what happens when they see a need and don't think it's being met in their own community? Or when they see something in their travels and think it should come to their community? A first impulse is often, let's bring it home. Let's make that happen for people in our backyard. It's not always as easy as all that. And we have here two people who have a lot of experience trying to do that. Our process today is going to be at a flying clip, unfortunately. The session scheduled for just an hour, so we'll try to move very fast. We have for you two caselets, two mini case studies of families who thought about and considered bringing new projects or organizations to their own communities, and we'll have you working on those. Those are the pink and the yellow, and each table will be working on only one, and then we'll talk. But first, let me let Casey introduce herself. Casey's from the Greenlight Fund, and then Debbie, and we'll take it from there.
Great, thank you, Amy. Good afternoon, everybody. I feel like somewhat of an anomaly here because the Greenlight Fund is not a family foundation. So if you want to chase me right on out of here at the end of this, I completely understand. But what we do and what we're known for is bringing the best to our backyards. And so in that way, I'm very excited to be here to kind of share some of the lessons that we've learned, some of our best practices that we used to get at bringing the best in. And not just bringing the best in, but keeping them in and having them have significant impact in the communities and being sustainable in those communities. A little bit about my background has mainly been actually on the nonprofit side, and have gotten a chance to see what expansion and replication looks like and how painful it is from that side. And now I've kind of switched over on the other side, and all actually in the Greenlight Fund family. So Greenlight Fund is an investment model. We're known around the country as importers. And we started in Boston about 9 years ago. And we were really started with the idea that there are critical unmet needs in our local communities, and there are amazing, powerful, innovative organizations all around the country. And if we could just find that best fit between those two, and then try to remove many of the barriers that a lot of nonprofit organizations see when they're coming into a new community, try to remove as many of those barriers or lessen them, that we could really see amazing results and impact for our children and families. And so over the last 9 years, Greenlight Fund in Boston has been testing out this theory and this model, and we've been refining our investment model. To date, we've now imported 7 organizations into the greater Boston area that were not there previously. And I can speak for at least one of them, as I was one that they imported in, Raising Arrear, which actually grew up not maybe 30 miles from here, not too far away from here in the Bay Area. And so we are really have kind of set up a model of due diligence and selection that we feel pretty good about in how we go around and look at what is pretty amazing and to bring in, and have a pretty good track record thus far. We're in a place now where we thought we figured this out for Boston, but we know there are other communities around the country that might be able to use this investment model and this strategy. And just this last year launched Greenlight Fund Philadelphia and Greenlight Fund San Francisco Bay Area, of which I had the wonderful honor to come back into the Greenlight Fund family, and not as a grantee, but to come in and launch Greenlight Fund Bay Area here. And so kind of how, to give you a little bit of an idea of what we do, it's kind of broken down into three buckets to think about it. We select, we launch, and we support. And that sounds very simple, but there's so many steps in between. When we're selecting organizations, we are very much driven by what the local community needs. That's the driver of everything that we do. So there's a lot of work on the front end in our local communities in talking with family foundations and talking with other funders and talking with community-based organizations, superintendents, policy folks, looking at data, really trying to understand what are the critical needs, and in this case for Greenlight Fund, what are the critical needs for at-risk children and their families in urban communities? And we're trying to see where those gaps are. And then we take an eye around the country, and we look all over the country to see who might be addressing that critical need. In the case of the organization that Greenlight Fund imported in that I was working with, Raising Arrear, they were looking for an investment in early childhood education. They were looking for something that had family involvement to it, and they were looking for a literacy component because all three of those were very much needed in the greater Boston area and did not exist. And they combed all over the country, and they found Raising Arrear, which hits all of those three and had a proven track record behind it. So we vet organizations, as you can imagine, kind of a large pipeline, and then whittling them down until there's this really perfect match. We do that not alone and not in isolation as Greenlight Fund. We actually do that in partnership with our local community through a selection advisory council that's made up of nonprofit leaders, made up of our fellow funders, is made up of policy folks, is made of private sector folks, and anybody that might have a really interesting point of view in thinking about organizations that we might want to bring in and invest in. And they advise us all along the way of our selection process until we get to the full diligence phase where we go out and do site visits. And then we usually narrow it down 2 to 3 candidates that we're looking at. And then we invite them to come in and present to our council and to Greenlight Fund, and we select one per year to invest in. We give them, and this is where we kind of get to the launch and the support phase. Once we select one, we do unrestricted funding, multi-year funding. We also take a seat on their board. We help build their board. We sit on their board for 6 years. We help build their board. We introduce them to donors, partners in the community. All of those barriers that we've heard about, that we've known, that have been researched, that when an organization's trying to come into a new community, they tend to face. And we also are very much at the table in helping hire the local leadership. Usually, and this for us, it's a local executive director. We're usually a part of the search committee. We could be working with the search firm. And sometimes we often have veto power in who they hire because we think that's such a critical place. So for our intention, we want to attract and bring the best into our backyard when we know it can be that great fit, but we also want them to be sustainable. We don't want to bring them in, fund them, get them here, and then 2 or 3 years later, 4 years later, 5 years later, when our funding, when they're slowly weaning down, there's a cliff, they drop off, and then they say, now what do we do? That there's been this wonderful community that has been a part of bringing them in, a wonderful community that has embraced them as they're starting to take root, and a wonderful community that has really been thoughtful partners as they're thinking about long-term sustainability. And so we have a track record of 7 in Boston, and in about 4 weeks, we're selecting our first 2 to bring here into the Bay Area, which I'm very excited about. And I'm looking forward to our discussion today, but also looking forward to sharing other little tricks of the trade or gems that we've been calling that we've learned along the way that might be beneficial to you all.
Thanks, Casey.
Thank
Debbie,
you.
Why don't you introduce yourself?
Okay.
She's a foundation consultant from Miami.
Yes, I am. I'm also very excited to be here. I struggle a lot with these replication issues, both as a funder myself on a family foundation and as a philanthropic consultant. So I'm very excited to have our heads together here and to hear what you all have to say and what your experiences have been. I've worked in the nonprofit sector for a long time, a couple decades at least, in multiple roles. As I said, I'm a funder myself. I've been a grantee. I've been in senior management of nonprofits. I've done a lot of program design, organizational development. And also on the governance side, I've been a board member, and I'm sure many of you have these multiple hats as well. I've worked in startup ventures and also the expansion and development of established organizations and programs. Currently, I am a philanthropic consultant. I've been one for 10 years now, and the majority of my clients are family foundations. So I typically work with family foundation over a long period of time, and in that, over those years, their philanthropic interests may shift a bit. There's a certain evolution into their approach to giving and their grant making. But there are a couple constants that speak to most family foundations. And the first being that they direct a large portion of their dollars to local communities, to the communities or regions where they are based, or where their wealth was made, or where family members reside or spend a lot of time. The other thing about family foundations is that their philanthropy is informed by their personal experience, by their passions, what comes from their heart, and they address problems or conditions that really touch them. And so I come along into that picture, and I try to help them develop a grant-making strategy that connects those passions with community needs. And in the process of doing so, of course, no one wants to waste resources by reinventing the wheel. And so I'm often charged with identifying successful programs and organizations and guiding the replication process on behalf of my clients. So I guess what we'll do right now is move into, so we all have a chance to talk about these issues. You will see I'm not sure about that third table now, but everybody should.
Third table has the yellow case, right?
Okay. There are two case studies. There's a pink case and a yellow case. These are two cases that are real. These are not hypotheticals. They are clients of mine, actually, who faced these opportunities or situations that you'll see in the each case study. The pink one is a program called Start with the Arts that a client of mine brought to their community about 8 or 9 years ago, and that uses the arts to promote literacy. And the other is an organization. The yellow case is an organization that that works with children who have a parent with a life-threatening illness that a client of mine is currently considering how they might help support that organization to expand, to be brought to scale, and hopefully to be brought to their own community. So that's kind of a work in process right now. These cases are what I'll say kind of on opposite ends of the replication spectrum, if you look at it as a spectrum, because there's many different ways you could replicate. You could replicate a part of one program, like Start with the Arts. You could replicate the whole program itself. You could replicate research, that's done on a particular issue in a community and have that done in your own community. You could go all the way to replicating the whole organization itself, the organizational culture. So there's quite a spectrum. The yellow case is looking more at that far end of the spectrum, looking at importing a whole organization, how you would go about replicating a whole organization. So we're hoping you all will read through. We've made them as short and brief as possible. Read through the scenarios quickly. There are guided questions at the end to start a conversation. And then we'll give you about 15 minutes for this. And then we will discuss it, both of them, together, and try to tease out some best practices and some next steps for those of you who are looking at this replication question. So
we have two pink tables and now two yellow tables. Process-wise, remember I said we were going to fly. This is, we're going to give you 15 minutes, and we don't expect you to crack the whole nut. What we're asking is put yourself in the shoes of these two foundations and think about what you would need to know next. What would you need to ask? What would you need to figure out if you're thinking about bringing these programs to your own backyard? So at your tables, think, read, think, talk, and we can circulate during this, but we'll try not to talk because this
are
is...
Are any tables, is that too big, any table that you can move to the...
If anybody wants to reapportion the groups, you're welcome to do that. But, you know, there may be people drifting in as well. Do we got two?
Do you want us to go on the table?
I mean, you don't have to.
I think we should move that.
We have to use here because we're recording on the mic.
Okay, everybody. I hate to interrupt. It sounds like there's a lot of great conversation going on, but we're gonna take these now one case at a time. So remember that each of you has only read the pink or the yellow. We'll try to make sure to include everybody in the discussion. They may say, somebody might say, what? And you'll explain why you ask those questions. I'm gonna serve as the scribe, and I'm gonna let these the two experts.
I hate to be called an expert.
I'm sorry.
Expertise is in the room.
Yes, and the expertise is in the room. Okay. Our two commentators actually answer, and I'm going to write some of this down. By the end, we will have some list of good practices to send out, you know, to give you. But we're going to elaborate on that, partly from what we learned from you. So Steve is circulating a list for email addresses. If you put yours down, we'd be happy to send you kind of a follow-up digest of some of the thoughts that we have afterwards. So I'm going to let these ladies run this, and I'm going to write it down. But on the Start with the Arts, which was the pink case, we have two tables, one and a half tables, who thought about that. We'd love to hear you in whatever. So pick up your hands, pick up the mic, and what would you do next?
Can someone set the stage for this?
Non-pink.
Non-pink. Okay, good.
Okay, this was a case where The family was a family foundation. The trustees were interested in funding in education, and particularly came down to early childhood education after a whole lot of conversation and investigation, and particularly around literacy, around early childhood education. And through a scan of some of the, where we're very impressive literacy early childhood education programs around the country, there was one identified that was sort of the model. You know, if you could have everything, you had unlimited resources, this would be seemingly a fabulous program to bring into the community. The key element of it was that there was a speech pathologist in every pre-K classroom, regardless. This wasn't about special needs particularly of any of the children, but that all children could benefit from having that kind of expertise in the classroom. The classrooms were built around themes for the week, you know, transportation 1 week or 2 weeks, and the whole classroom became an airport, and you had to have, you know, boarding passes to get into to school that day. And I mean, this is a whole, quite an interesting program, but it was way too expensive for this foundation to undertake at that point in their philanthropy. They'd been formed only a couple years at that point, and it just seemed too overwhelming and big of an enterprise to try to bring that into their community. So we started to look at more modest kind of programs, but some that might have the same elements that we saw in this, what I'll call the model program. And so we did identify that, and that is this program called Start with the Arts. It's actually a piece, it's almost like a curriculum of, you know, within a larger program. So it's a part of a program that this family imported into their community. So that's the stage. That's the background of the case. Is that enough to go on?
And for those who want, there are extra paid copies, so if you want to end up taking those home, don't need now probably, but those are available to you. So, pink tables,
well, you started to answer some of the questions in that background, but we started with, you know, what were the elements of the original model program mm-hmm. that were in this, and, you know, and why did they decide it wasn't affordable as opposed to trying to go and build other funding in order to get that the original program in place. And then we started talking about, you know, the need for, well, what do the local providers of child care services think about this curriculum? Mm-hmm. Do they have the capacity to implement it? Do they have the staff that can take this curriculum and run with it? Will they be willing partners? Do we know who all the providers are? Are they public? Are they private? Are they somewhere in between? How does this fit in with the state model that's being launched? And the suggestion was made that did the foundation think about going to the state and trying to get them to adopt a curriculum like this as part of?
Not in Florida.
Yeah.
No, go ahead.
You know, what kind of training would be needed to implement this? What does it mean that there's an affiliate in the state? You know, are they willing to come and implement this program, or does that just mean we can get the curriculum from somebody? I don't, there was a lot of other things brought up, but that's what I remember.
Others at the tables? Other things that you want to know? Other things that you want to explore? Other things that you worry about? Again, pick up the mic if you would.
Okay. Something that we were also reflecting on was, you know, what's the population of the community that this model is implemented in, to see if it's reflective of the population of your own home city. Because what we found is with best practices, it may work well for that group, but if there's one thing that's off in terms of replication, it may change the outcomes. So just making sure that the key components of the model is actually something that's achievable in your home city. And, you know, also mentioned about what resources, what capacity it would bring. Would this be a totally new organization, or would it be, would the public school take it over? Would there be this affiliate, or would another nonprofit provider be interested in taking that on but just didn't have the capacity to do it, and so you could help them with that?
Yeah. Right? No, these are, I want to respond, but I know we're going to do the yellow case, so I'm sort of holding back because these questions are all great.
We're okay if you want to respond. I mean, do you want to respond now, or do you want to? should we go for the yellow case?
Well, I'd love to just highlight the kind of the two. I mean, there was so many wonderful things that you know kind of brought out of this, but the two big things is hearing the buy-in. So, and which I think also is attributed to determining is there really a need for this, and then if there is a need for this, are the players who are there, and who will be living with this, will they embrace it? And that's great. That's absolutely great to hear. I think the other thing is who owns it is also what I heard. Once it's here, it's one thing to kind of set the stage for it and try to understand if we think that this could be a good fit in. But once it comes in, who's going to own it? Will it be the foundation that's driving it and owning it? And do they understand their role in that? Are they okay that this could be a long-term funding piece? Are they trying to go in jointly with other funders and thinking about the sustainability of this? Are they hoping that they may trigger it in, but that the school district or other entities would then own something like this? And what is the likelihood if they start cutting funding at the school district? Would this be the first thing to go? So really thinking about who owns it and how long the foundation wants to own it or what kind of owner they want to be in it, and partnering with others. And what's that long-term sustainability look like? So if the funder walks away in 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, what does this program, this model, this organization, depending on the example, what does it look like in that community and who's driving it? Those are critical, critical questions to ask on the front end and not to ask after you brought it in.
You can tell we've got people itching to respond. Let's go to the yellow case.
Oh, you want to go to the yellow case?
I think we better, because you just told me I better keep
You're killing me. Okay. All right, we're going to the yellow.
I promise, we may run over a few minutes. If you want to stay, we'll finish this discussion at least in the hour and five. Yellow case. Debbie, you want to give a very brief background for the pink
benefit
people
of
about
the pink
what
people.
The yellow case was?
Yeah, the yellow case is a situation. This is a family who, unfortunately, there were several members of the family. Well, let me take a step back. The foundation is the board of the foundation are the adult children of the founder of the foundation, and there were several family members that unfortunately had cancer, and all those adult children had young children, school age children, couple of them, of the directors, actually passed away, and one recovered, you know, is in a remission situation. But they all had these young children, and it was quite tragic. I mean, the whole, it's an incredible family, incredibly philanthropic family, and then all this happens to them. And they realized in their community that particularly the one daughter whose husband had a brain tumor, and they realized that there was no support services for their children, who at the time of diagnosis were maybe 5 years old, I think, twins. And there were no support services for the kids. There were support services for the person with cancer, support services for the caregivers, but nothing for the children. And there were clear changes in the household, to say, you know, to say the least, both the kind of illness he had, and if there were personality changes, he was a different role as a father and all these sorts of things. So anyway, the daughter, the wife of this person decided there was nowhere to take her children. She was looking desperately, and there was nothing available. So she really drove this. I put her in touch with other organizations, but they were more like bereavement centers. They weren't really about parents living with cancer. And we eventually, she decided, you know, there was a certain urgency at the time because all this was going on while he was sick. She decided to really push this thing forward. She wanted, probably driven to have the services for her own children. They placed it at a hospital. We managed to get the hospital to agree to actually hold the sessions. These were like support sessions for the kids on a school campus, not in a hospital setting. But basically, it wasn't the right partner for the for this kind of work, and the target on young children. It just wasn't, or any children, even teenagers. It just wasn't the right partner for it. And after a couple years of funding, quite substantial funding, the foundation decided to no longer continue to support that effort there. But they still saw this great need. And it was at that point that we really systematically went out and looked and identified an organization in another state. It's a program called Wonders and Worries. It's a fabulous program that offers some of the same things. We reinvented the wheel in the program they had at the hospital in terms of successions and these kinds of things. But this program was way beyond that, much more comprehensive, much more, and in any case, it looked really promising. And they are now seriously, as I said, we're currently looking at this organization very seriously about replicating it. And so that's the basics of the case.
And so we ask the yellow tables, what do you want to know about your community? What do you want to know about the organization? What do you want to know about the program itself? And where would you turn for that information? I see a volunteer.
We had a lot of answers for that one. For our own community, market survey, how many families are looking for this kind of support? What programs like this already exist in the area? Why did the hospital-based program fail? Were there not enough patients? Was there not enough hospital support? What other funders in the area would be interested in going in with us for this program? Is there another program in the area that is doing something similar that we could either just tweak or help them change their model? What is the experience of the other two cities where the program expanded into? What kind of issues did they have? What kind of problems did they have? How is this community different than the other communities where it went into? Does the medical community support this? Get them advice, get an advisory board together, have the organization come make a presentation, have an advisory committee to open up discussion and hear from the constituents.
Wow.
And
I'm going to put you on the spot for a minute. Would you put some money behind getting the answers to those questions?
Absolutely.
Okay. Just checking, because sometimes we want all as family foundations, we want all this information, and then when it costs money to get the answers, we flip out a little bit.
Since we had the same case, can I just augment?
Yes, that's just what we wanted to do, all the same stuff.
There was one thing around the why did it fail that we were thinking about. There's failures of the partnership, so is it just the wrong partner, and what other community assets might we build upon? Is it a matter of transferring to, a youth organization that's already reaching young people and knows how to work with young people but doesn't do this particular thing? And then also, or is it a failure of implementation? Like, did they just not do it right? And so we thought about having a focus group with the families that left to better understand what didn't work for them.
Are we getting ready to move on to the program we're looking at?
Go ahead. Ask what you want to know about the program.
One of the things we discussed was that what we do know about this program is this program was able to analyze its community and develop itself in such a way as it worked. So we wondered if perhaps that process, rather than the program itself, is what needed to be replicated.
Okay.
Just to be clear, that the process of identifying the need for the program?
Just of identifying the need, but of figuring out what works and what doesn't, how the program was developed.
So you might want to replicate their method rather than their
design process.
design, their perhaps. Design process rather than necessarily their final design solution. Okay. Other comments from Yellow Tables? And then now I'm going to turn you loose. We don't have a lot of time, but go for it.
These are all great. I mean, everything you have raised, this foundation had almost the same set of questions. What they were able to do, which I think is an important thing when family foundations are looking at this, is they decided to take a step back, and there was a lot of conversation with the original partner for that program, a lot of trying to help it along in the time that it was housed with them. That hospital, by the way, is continuing the program with other funders. So there was a whole lot of conversation around that. The family, but it felt sort of like forcing a square peg in a round hole. That hospital was devoting, it was in a section of the hospital where they had social work. They insisted for liability reasons that social workers had to run these programs for the kids, which made it more costly. They also were not able to dedicate, which is a common problem, I think, when you're replicating. If you're housing a program or a part of a program in another organization, you're subject to whatever the goals and the structure of that organization and the way it's administered and managed. You can't escape that. So I would say there was not dedicated staff to this program. The person who was assigned, you know, as the administrator of the program, maybe 15-20% of her time was spent on that program. It just wasn't sufficient to really move it to the next level. There was the feeling that it was going to kind of stay where it was at. So I think the lesson out of there is, because probably most commonly a family foundation would be replicating into another existing organization, is to really look at that partnership and that setup. In contrast with Start With The Arts, that program, it was a very good fit. It was ended up being housed at a museum that had a very strong educational department and an educational mission. And they took to that program like, wow, this is really a way for us to meet our own organizational goals and how they were trying to build their educational department, and at the same time have the impact on the children that program was designed to have. So there's a lot of lesson in there on partners. There's also, in both cases, the family-funded planning. They said it is really important to take a step back and look at the planning process and put money behind that, and also an expectation and an understanding of the time it takes to do adequate planning. In both cases, it was... it was less for Start With The Arts, but I would say a year of planning and how that was going to roll out. And in terms of this organization that they're now looking at replicating, that's in a planning process. The foundation has funded them to work with an outside consultant who is a real expert on bringing nonprofits to scale. But it's a lot of dollars going into that initial planning to see if it's worth further investment. I mean, it's just kind of have to, you know, they felt really strongly about doing that. The other piece that, and you all have raised these kinds of questions, the issue of a pilot. That's a very often preliminary way that an organization or a program gets replicated. They say, all right, let's test it out somewhere. In the case of the Wonders and Worries is the program that they're talking about bringing into, it's working with the children with the ill parents. They had piloted sort of, it came to them to try different communities to pilot. It was a little bit random, I'll put it that way. So they're in questioning now is, do you come to this Family Foundations community as a pilot? Does that make sense? And a lot of conversation about, well, if you're going to do that as a pilot, you need to know up front, what do you need to know from the pilot experience? You can't just try it without knowing what you're trying to get out of it. If it's a pilot, it's a learning lab. You're trying to understand what is going to help you. So that was another key part. And they funded, they're looking at how this organization has piloted itself and whether it makes sense to pilot in the community. In the case of Start with the Arts, they were already funding inner city Catholic schools. And they said, all right, we know we're only going to reach a smaller number of kids in the inner city Catholic school, but let's pilot the program in the inner city Catholic school. It's a more controlled environment. It's a learning lab that they could then understand the value of the program. Was it something that there was buy-in for? Were the teachers and the principals of those schools really taking to the program? Were the children benefiting? The evaluation process was piloted there as well to understand if there was impact on the kids. And from there, after 2 years of pilots at different age groups and how many times they're in the museum, how many times the museum goes to the school, and all the details of this were kind of figured out in the laboratory of the smaller private inner city Catholic schools. And since then, they've been able to bring it into the public school system. But it was a very important look at the importance of piloting and how you can get something out of that. And funding that.
And we're at 4 o'clock, but I'm going to keep us going for a minute. I saw a hand there, so ask your question, and then I want to turn to Casey, who has a lot of experience looking at the organization that's going to be replicated, and we're going to give her a couple minutes to talk about that, even though we're running over.
Someplace very similar to where you plan to expand it, as opposed to you'd have to almost pilot again in a public school, right?
Well, this is something about replication that you have to think about. What you're really trying to replicate are the results. You're not trying to replicate the program or organization per se. Yeah. So the purpose of that pilot in that case was to say, is this having impact? Is this really aiding in the literacy and language development of these young children? And so in that way, and then you could evaluate that and demonstrate that and then bring it to another level into the public system. But you're 100% right. That's why I'm saying you need to know what is the information you want out of your pilot before you set your pilot up.
Let's give Casey some time, because
just quick, some quick things that we take a very laser eye kind of focus on at Greenlight Fund when we're thinking about bringing the best into our backyard and importing, that absolutely came out in this discussion, but I just want to kind of, touch on before we leave as kind of the what you're leaving with. If you leave with nothing else, that it meets a critical need in your community, that you're not bringing something in that 15 other people are doing in your community, that you're really trying to fit a critical need, a gap there, and for a variety of reasons of why you would not want to displace what's already in there. Some of it is where there's a gap that nobody's doing this, so we want to bring it in, and some of it's the harder question of, there's people here that might be doing this, but are they doing it well? And are they getting significant impact? And that's a much harder one to get at. The other thing is, we talked about results. Results for us are absolutely critical. And to our Los Angeles colleagues, I think you pointed out of, it's great if it's worked and you have results demonstrate it's worked with this demographic. But if that is completely different than the demographic of our backyard, are we okay with that? Are we okay with piloting it, or are we okay with maybe that's not going to work for us? Maybe we don't want to take that risk, and maybe we want to look at something else that might have demonstrated results that could work with our demographic, work with our community. Or we can make a pretty well-educated guess that it could come in and work. And then you definitely, I think it was this table that touched on it, but looking at their track record of expansion, have they expanded elsewhere? If they have, how successful was it? Was it successful going to Omaha? Was it successful going to Kansas City? Was it successful coming into Oakland? And unpacking that a little bit. Was it the local leadership that was successful? Was it the partnership that made it successful? And really trying to understand that so you can understand what that might mean for success for bringing it into your community. And then the last two things I'll say is sustainability. You heard me say it again, but I can't hit it home because I think oftentimes a local champion gets very excited about something and says it needs to come in, and they fund it, and it comes in, and unfortunately nobody else is excited about it, and then that organization fails. And so thinking about sustainability, what is this going to look like 5 years from now, 10 years from now, what role are we playing, and are we okay with playing in that time? And the last thing is, you can't do it alone. At any stage for us, when we're selecting, when we're launching, and when we're supporting, Greenlight Fund does not do it alone. We do it in partnership with our community.
Can I have my...
You can have it,
shot.
Absolutely.
Okay, I just want to say that I think it's important for foundations to understand that the nonprofit sector has not done really well with replication. There's not a whole lot of successful examples, certainly of bringing organizations to scale. It's almost non-existent. I think it's important to understand some of the reasons why that's the case, because then as a foundation, you can start to target what you should fund that would help the replication process along. So for example, a lot of it is there's a lack of attention to the importance of infrastructure and management in an organization trying to replicate things. And so to fund more of that, what we would call overhead, which maybe you don't fund normally in projects existing in your community, but you need to fund it for the replication piece, just to put those kind of ideas in your head. There are a whole host of other reasons that I don't have time to go through about why this replication has been so difficult for the sector. But I think it's important to understand the context in which you're funding. Talking about that system, what are the pressures on the system to try to replicate, on the nonprofit sector that causes these problems in replication? I think you need to look at funding and maybe potentially, I don't know how you're funding now, but in a slightly different way when you're talking about funding replication. So you fund planning, you fund research, you fund pilots that are set up as the way we just discussed. You consider that potentially for the financial sustainability that Casey was talking about, that you fund in a way that's setting up that program or organization to receive larger funding or attract greater funding. I think there's some family foundations that, there's a lot of pressure on the funding community now to fund sort of the latest, greatest, most innovative idea, and I just want to leave you with the thought that sometimes this replication piece, even though it may not be as sort of sexy to bring in the new idea, but something a little more tested or tried and tested, is innovative in and of itself, because there are such problems with this replication. If you as a funder can be part of having a successful replication, that's huge. It's a huge contribution, not just to your community and the program you're bringing in there and the target population you're affecting, but to the field itself, to have more examples of these successful replications. So
we've gone over. Thank you for your forbearance.
You.
Sorry about
that. But too much. We're here for a little